From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm John McKay sitting in for Chris Boyd. America has gone through some uneasy times since the end of the Cold War. Troubles in Iraq, Afghanistan, increasing division here at home, a seeming retreat from international leadership, while the power of others such as China, India, Russia, appears on the rise. Has American sway in world affairs disappeared? It's not a new topic for William Woolforth. He's been writing about foreign policy, power, and perceptions for decades. He's the Daniel Webster Professor of Government at Dartmouth College. He wrote The Myth of Multipolarity for Foreign Affairs magazine, along with fellow Dartmouth professor Stephen Brooks. William Woolforth joins us this hour. Welcome to Think.
Well, I'm delighted to be here. I look forward to the conversation.
You know, if you listen to most of the people who purport to be experts today, you get the impression that American dominance has absolutely ended. I want to read this. This is from another article, not your article. This is from Foreign Affairs magazine. And this person writes, as Asia continues its economic ascent, two centuries of Western domination in the world, first under Pax Britannica and then under Pax Americana, are coming to an end. The West is losing not only its material dominance, but also its ideological sway. That is not your view, but that's pretty typical of what you hear people talking about today, isn't it?
It is. And to be clear, our focus in this article is on the material part of the story, namely, you know, what resources do you bring to the table as a country? What real capabilities do you have to induce cooperation, attract allies, or potentially deal with adversaries if the push comes to shove. And by, I think, the best, you know, metrics you can use, the United States remains a very, very central player and indeed dominates in the scales of global capability the other international actors, even including China, its closest contender. And to explain why you see such a cacophony of voices arguing otherwise, I think you have to think about the reference point. What are they comparing today to? And I think what they're comparing today's situation to is the heyday of American unipolar dominance of the 1990s and early 2000s. And on that front, my co-author Brooks and I agree, yes, China has risen a great deal since then. The United States has declined considerably. So we're not in that world. But we're also not in a world that bears comparison productively to either the Cold War bipolarity or the multipolar world orders that existed for hundreds of years prior to the Cold War.
So, you know, so this idea of perhaps I guess we should go with some definitions. This idea of unipolarity and multipolarity, what exactly are you talking about? We're not talking about just influence.
Yeah, we're talking about the power capabilities that states use to get influence. And essentially, the only way to kind of use a concept like polarity is to come up with some clear definition, which we do in the article, and then apply it sort of objectively through time to compare, for example, how powerful is the United States today vis-a-vis China compared to how powerful was the United States vis-a-vis the Soviet Union back in the Cold War. And so you need to kind of keep your definitions constant. And what we notice in the article is that a lot of people sort of change a definition and start thinking of multipolarity as any case in which the United States doesn't get what it wants, or somebody disses the United States and it can't respond, or the United States needs allies to get things done as opposed to being able to do things on its own. And sure, all those metrics show the United States does suffer all of those constraints. It needs allies. It doesn't always get what it wants. There are other sources of influence in the world. But if you look at this rigorous definition of polarity as actual material capabilities, the United States remains in a class of its own in international politics.
You know, this idea of multipolarity, China, Iran, Russia, they like that idea, don't they?
Absolutely. I mean, wouldn't you? It gives you a lot more sway in international relations. It feels better to be bigger. and stronger for most countries. If you look at Russia, for example, Russia has been saying that it wanted multipolarity, that multipolarity is on the verge of occurring or about to happen. Why, it's been saying that ever since Putin became president. In fact, even before that. And for Russians, what multipolarity means is we get to have our own sphere of influence. We get to tell Ukraine what it does. We get to say whether it can be in NATO or whether it has to be with us, Russia. And from the standpoint of the Russian leadership, multipolarity is awesome because multipolarity to them means America will respect our ability to tell our neighbors exactly what they do. And so, sure, they like that.
Yeah, you're right that there are also some other nations that kind of echo this idea. For example, India and others, I guess, in the global south.
Yes, I think that for legitimate and important reasons, lots of countries in the global south resent the idea of Western or U.S. dominance. And there's a lot of things they don't like about it, including what they see as hypocrisy, whereas we say there's a rules-based international order, you have to follow the rules, but then we ourselves often don't follow the rules. So all of that, I get that. And I think for a lot of intellectuals, elites, policymakers coming from the global south, when they say multipolarity, they mean a world in which the West is sort of cut back down to size and assumes a somewhat more humble role in international politics. And once again, you know, that's a reasonable position, and I probably would feel the same way if I were in those countries. That doesn't mean, though, that the West and the United States leading a group of allies do not, in fact, retain very, very significant advantages in terms of technology, military capability, and even their overall aggregate economic capabilities.
Now, you have said, you know, it's fair to say that during the Cold War, the world was bipolar. Is that right? I want to make sure that I've got that right.
Yes, that was a bipolar world. I grew up in that world. I spent the first part of my career studying the Cold War and Soviet Union and its relative power. And that's one of the things Steve and I say in the article that's gotten the most pushback. We say that China is not now as formidable a peer competitor as the Soviet Union was during the Cold War. Well, a lot of people hear that and say, what are you talking about? China is so dynamic, has such a huge economy, is so growing at such rapid pace. But the thing is, the Soviet Union had a military capability that was a peer of the United States. And that military capability was positioned such that it could credibly threaten to conquer key centers of world power. That's what the United States was so worried about in the Cold War. And I know now we want to look back in hindsight and say, oh, they were always a paper tiger or a paper bear. Look, they collapsed in 1991. Fact is, they were a very, very, very formidable a military power that in some periods of the Cold War actually had the advantage over the United States in key categories of military capability. We tend to forget this because our minds sort of are focused on the period since the 1980s when the United States kind of attained a position of technological dominance over the Soviet Union. But that was only at the end of the Cold War. That wasn't through most of it.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, beginning of the Cold War, if you looked at, for example, space exploration, it's a fair argument to say that in terms of rocket science, that sort of thing, 50s, 60s, they were ahead in the beginning.
They were ahead in some ways. They kind of beat the U.S. to the punch in terms of rocket capability or missile capability, mm-hmm. partly through in World War II, their forces came into the part of Germany that contained Hitler's rocket program. We got Werner von Braun, but they got a lot of other rocket scientists, and they moved ahead rather rapidly on that. But also just in terms of, the technological level of their armed forces was totally comparable to the United States until the latter part of the Cold War. Early on, from the 50s and 60s, they were really at the same plane, but the Soviet Union had more than we had, and certainly had more in Europe. So it was a really tight race back then. We were kind of on tenterhooks trying to keep up.
You know, when the Soviet Union collapsed, you point this out in the article, we had a bit of a rarity in terms of modern history, because the United States really stood by itself at the end of the Soviet Union. Is that fair?
It is fair. And, you know, back then, you could basically pick any measure you wanted of a country's power, whatever measure you wanted. And the United States was ahead on all of them. And that truly was unprecedented. And that is no longer the case, as we frankly acknowledge in the article. If you just look at, say, GDP, annual economic output, on that measure, China is comparable to the United States. So that era in which you could pick any measure is over. Still, we say, if you pick the right ones, the most important ones, the ones that are most probative for the question at hand, then the United States still retains important areas of preeminence.
You know, you say in the article that never since the birth of the modern state system in the mid-17th century had any country been so far ahead in military, economic, and technological realms simultaneously as was the period right at the end of the Soviet Union. So this was really an unusual situation in terms of even the history of this country, even before this country.
That's right. I mean, never in the Cold War did the United States ever have anything like the kind of dominance over the Soviet Union that it had over Russia, China, and the rest as of 1992, 93, 94, all the way into the beginning of the new millennium. It was truly unprecedented. And that's based on a lot of research. I guess I would ask listeners to think, you know, can you think of another case where one country had such dominance? We can always think of certain areas where a state had dominance. For example, people will often think of the British Navy in the 18th and 19th centuries. And so there were, or colonial holdings, you know, the British had a huge overseas empire, but it was always confronted with other powers that had other kinds of capability, like Russia with a gigantic land army in the 19th century, or Russia with a huge empire. It just wasn't an overseas empire, it was a land empire. And so it's really a unique occurrence in international politics, certainly since kind of the European type of state system developed in the 17th century, that we saw a situation such as that moment that occurred after the end of the Cold War and the collapse of the Soviet Union.
You know, to have multipolarity, you said that you really need to have a third country in this mix of dominant influence and ideas. I rack in my brain, none seem to come to my mind. People like to say France or India, but would there be a third country?
That's the problem. I mean, absolutely. If you want to have, if it's one country at the top, you've got unipolarity. If it's two, you've got bipolarity, and you need three or more for multi. And if you look at it, you know, who's third? India is awesome. It's growing. It is huge in population, but it's still too poor, really, to stand up as a global power. And I don't think anybody in among foreign policy making circles there thinks that they're ready to take the global stage and project power globally. European countries like France, Germany, definitely important economic players, and so on and so forth. But come on. They're not in the same comparison. Their populations are simply too small. So really, it's down to a U.S.-China comparison here. And that's really where the argument is. The multipolar idea just doesn't cut it.
The United Kingdom. The same case with the United Kingdom, for example.
Sure.
It's sizable, but not there.
Yeah, it's a very significant middle power. It has its economy is now in trouble, but it's got a serious economy. It has a very significant defense and technological capability. But if you just look at the numbers, it's not in contention. And you know, one way to think about this is if you look at aiding Ukraine, the help that the United States and its allies have given to Ukraine. In the case of U.S. European allies, they have genuinely given a lot of what they had to give. There just isn't a lot of military industrial capacity waiting there. whereas the United States has devoted about 1% of its federal budget to the Ukraine aid programs. Very important. It's big. But if you just look at the relative hit each of these countries has taken for aiding Ukraine, the disparity between what the United States has done and what the Europeans has done just shows you how much larger the reservoir of power from which the United States is drawing when it's helping Ukraine.
Professor, you know, a lot of people who want to talk about all of this bring up the idea of gross domestic product being a way to measure changes in polarity. And that is what some use, and as are, for example, for China and its increase. Is that a good metric?
It's a flawed metric. It's important, but it is not sufficient, and it can be misleading for two reasons. Reason number one is China does cook the books when it comes to the statistics. There's a lot of literature on this we could get into, but basically there are significant discrepancies between reported GDP and actual GDP. And indeed, we have a quote from a former Chinese prime minister who basically told an American interlocutor that, hey, we can't really trust these numbers. And so economists come up with all kinds of other ways of objectively measuring China's economic performance. And unfortunately, since Xi Jinping has concentrated power, even those statistics are not being published the way they used to be. And so we try to find metrics that are sort of impossible to fake or that capture the real value added of the Chinese economy. And it's still formidable. It's still big. It's the second largest economy in the world, no doubt about it. But when you use indicators that control for sort of the actual what people are willing to pay for their technology and so on and so forth, you do get a much more moderated, constrained picture of China's economic capabilities. The second reason why GDP, gross domestic product, is a flawed measure is you can't like overturn an international system with GDP. I mean, you actually have to have technological capacity, you have to have that military capability, you have to have allies, you have to have other assets. And when we measure those too, China, big, serious, major contender, but still has a significant gap to close with the United States. I'll just say that, you know, a lot of China experts who spend their professional lives studying the country and its foreign affairs say that really, frankly, many Chinese experts themselves, that is say Chinese decision makers and elites, doubt whether China's really ready to take on the United States at the global level. It's much more of a regional focused vision for now, according to at least a significant contingent of China watchers.
Here's another quote from the experts. I say that in, I put that in quotations. Around the world, democracies are falling prey to illiberalism and populist dissension, while the rising China, assisted by a pugnacious Russia, seeks to challenge the West's authority and Republican approaches to both domestic and international governance. You know, I can remember, Professor, back in 2019, Vladimir Putin, in an interview with the Financial Times, he said, look, Western liberalism, the kind that we champion here in America, that's obsolete. And that, I imagine, is part of his and others' argument for multipolarity.
Yes, it's a really interesting and important question. I think that one way of interpreting that rhetoric about the decline of democracy, democratic backsliding, liberal idea is dead, is partly actually defensive. In other words, in Beijing and in Moscow and in other authoritarian countries, their view is that we, the West, were being aggressive towards them and their need to become democracies. And so from the 1990s, the early 2000s, there was a freedom agenda. There was this idea of spreading human rights, all good, all wonderful ideas, but they are very, very threatening to an authoritarian regime. I mean, liberalism is a threat to an illiberal regime. And so much of the propaganda you're seeing, I think, they view as pushback. They're saying, hey, you calling into question our legitimacy, you're calling into question our Communist Party rule, or in Putin's case, my personalistic rule. Guess what? We're going to do the same thing to you. We're going to try to put you on the back foot. And so it's pugnacious, it's in your face, but there's actually a sense of insecurity behind some of it. That seeming edifice of autocracy seems so strong, never going anywhere. Actually, they're a little insecure about it. And some of that anti-liberal rhetoric that they're projecting around the world is in fact stemming from their own insecurity.
You've talked about military strength as a measurement. And it's fair to say that China has, they've definitely rapidly modernized their armed forces. But there is this concept that you discuss that I had not heard of, but really gives the U.S. an edge. And it's called command of the commons. What does that mean? And why is that so important?
It's the ability to use and to deny others potentially the use of the so-called global commons. That is the deep oceans outside of the territorial limit of states, and the air in that, and the sky, the atmosphere in those same areas, and the use of space for your military purposes. Now, the command of the commons is what enables the United States to exercise military capability in far-flung regions and deny others the capacity to do the same if it should choose to do so. And attaining that command of the commons is really difficult. It is very costly. It has been generations, not just decades, in the making. And for China or any other contender to replicate that command so that it could confidently project military power against U.S. resistance around the world would be a formidable undertaking. So thus far, this dramatic and very important Chinese military and modernization is focused mainly on its ability to exercise a power in its own region, which is really important. Nobody's denying it. But thus far, it's not seriously contesting that command of the commons. And so that is an important sort of indicator of superpower status that remains pretty much strongly an American game.
So what I think I'm hearing you saying is that China has improved its strength with regard to being a regional power, but has some distance to go in terms of a global power and challenging the United States.
Yes, and my understanding from China watchers is that there's a debate in China of whether that game is really worth the candle. I mean, to what degree, the question arises, does Beijing really want to try to be an arbiter and in places like the Middle East? There's no question that its capacity to exercise influence around the world is much greater than it used to be. They have a very large navy. They have sent forces out to deal with things like pirates off the Somali coast. They have obtained a small naval outpost. So their global presence is changing, but it is not yet at a status where it could deny the United States the capacity to move forces in these global commons. And that enables the United States to operate very powerfully in their region in a way that they can't replicate in other regions.
Yeah, China building islands, for example, that's this regional power strategy?
Yeah, I mean, it wants Taiwan back, and it wants to create credible military options vis-a-vis Taiwan. It wants to dominate and achieve its objectives in the South China Sea, namely to push back the capacity of local actors in those regions and to attain a kind of dominance in the South China Sea. And to achieve the latter, it has transformed these maritime features into sort of concrete islands. And that's sort of the way it has been exercising a certain degree of slow burn revisionism to change the status quo in the South China Sea. That's important. You know, nobody would discount it, but it is a regional objective. It is one that the United States could conceivably adjust to without dramatically altering our basic position in the world. Whereas back in multipolar or bipolar systems, the powers that were revisionists, they had the capacity to put like major centers of world power at risk. If we think, for example, of the Soviet Union, it was sitting there credibly threatening West Germany. And West Germany's economy was 70% the size of the Soviet economy at the time. you're talking about a major, major, major threat to change the world order. China is challenging the world order, but at a significantly more constrained margin than what we saw with past near peer competitors.
Let's go back in history a bit. Prior to the First World War, the British had just a massive empire, and I would imagine they would have been at that time. So this is prior to the First World War. That would be part of a multipolar war, or a multipolar world, I should say.
Yes, it was, because Britain had this huge navy and had all these colonial possessions, but Germany had a much bigger economy and a much bigger army, and Russia had a huge amount of territory and a much bigger army, and the United States economy dominated all of them. So in each of these major metrics, you had different people who could claim to be different states that could claim to be number one in a given area. That's what made it multipolar.
So after World War II, then, we had this bipolarity. So you've got the U.S. and you've got the Soviet Union. But one of the things that I found interesting in the article was also the fact that if it's really stability that we're after, if it's stability that we want in the world, no one really should wish for a multipolar world, because as you note in the article, war seems to break out fairly commonly in these multipolar worlds that you have.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I always struggle with as somebody who tries to compare historical international relations to the contemporary era. True multipolarity is a very dangerous system. Throughout those hundreds of years, we just had repeated lengthy, terrible great power wars. And partly it was because states were always on tenterhooks. You know, there was always some challenger that was one alliance choice away from really, you know, turning over the international system. So you're sitting there constantly sort of on watch, always worried about the next move could really lead to a dramatic change in your security or your prosperity or your national independence. And as fraught as the current world is, you know, as challenging as it is, it really doesn't bear a productive comparison to those kinds of systems. And so I'm not denying that many elites in many countries probably find the role of the United States and its Western allies in the world somewhat annoying and nettlesome. But to compare it with those systems, I think, is to show that there's a lot not to like about multipolarity.
Yeah, you go through the period from 1500 to 1945 and note that. We had the 30 Years' War, the wars of Louis XIV, the 7 Years' War, the Napoleonic Wars, World War I, World War II. And this is because of these, again, these shifting and uncertain alliances in the world of multipolarity.
Yeah, I mean, you would be in a situation where you thought, gosh, you know, if this other country were to switch its alliances or choose to ally against my enemy, I might be toast. And we cite one example in the article of the Tsar Paul of Russia around the turn of the 19th century, where, you know, we've got Napoleon's on the march and they're sitting in London saying, goodness, you know, if Napoleon keeps going, we're really in deep trouble. And meanwhile, Tsar Paul's thinking, gosh, maybe I should ally with rather than against Napoleon. And in London, that's just sending them into paroxysms of fear. In fact, Tsar Paul was ultimately assassinated, and some historians suspect Britain had a hand in it. Nobody knows for sure, but it's at least plausible, because had the Russian Empire allied to the French, why Britain's global position truly would have been in trouble. And as again, whatever's happening today with Taiwan, with South China Sea, with Ukraine, as bad as it is, America's fundamental security and prosperity, its entire global position, is not at stake in most of these, in these crises, in the way that they routinely were back in these multipolar systems.
So are we today then now in a kind of, I think you mentioned this, a partial unipolarity?
Yes. We say partial unipolarity because we're acknowledging that things are different than they were, you know, in that immediate post-Cold War, post-Soviet collapse period that you and I we're just talking about. So things are different, but they're still not multi or bipolar. And so you need, if you were to try to come up with some polarity term to describe where we are in the world, you're better off using some variant of unipolarity, partial, you know, slightly diminished, whatever you want to call it, than you are in invoking these other terms of bipolarity and multipolarity, because they're going to tend to be more misleading than they are enlightening. So you've got to kind of square their circle of saying, yes, folks, we recognize this ain't 1997 anymore. But at the same time say, but it also definitely isn't 1950 and it isn't 1913. It's a different thing. And so partial unipolarity is the term we came up with to capture that.
Well, what about China and Russia? You know, in recent weeks, months, we have seen them seem to work more in concert with each other. Upgrading their relations, that sort of thing. Is that a problem? Is that a change?
Well, I think it's serious. I think it matters, and it's serious, and one shouldn't be poo-pooing and dismissing the importance of that partnership. And however, what we say in the article is that the state of that partnership is not going to transform the world. That is to say, it's not going to have the same kind of portentous implications, for example, as the decisions the Russian Empire was making during the Napoleonic Wars. Like, wow, if Russia and China firmly conclude an alliance, then suddenly America's entire global position will change. Why? It's because they're mainly capable of this regional pushback or regional balancing against the United States rather than global balancing. And so, but the key thing is that there are many things that they could be doing that they aren't doing. And I think that's partly because China is calculating the costs and benefits of this and concluding that a full-scale alliance, which would involve the United China really suffering costs, really willing to get in the fight with China, with the United States on behalf of Russia, that game isn't worth the candle for China. It's worried about what the ramifications of that could be.
You're not just talking about influence. We're talking about convincing people to do what you want, that sort of thing, right?
Yes. I mean, if you look at influence, there are, you know, what can I do tomorrow to get country X to do what I want? That's really, I'm happy to admit, and you know, that's really the currency of international relations. That's what you want. But that changes rapidly. It's very contingent. And this idea of polarity is a way of capturing, like, well, what resources do you bring to the table in all of these conversations? And so that is a distinct thing, but they are related over the long term. And so it does matter that the United States retains these various advantages. You know, one thing I'd quickly say on that front is that, you know, often you measure, you know, a country's influence by what it's able to get to have happen, you know, like, do this or we'll be really mad at you. And then the newspaper reports, gosh, America wasn't able to get what it wanted. But you have to also bear in mind that a lot of what we want is for things not to happen, you know, deterrence. You want to have countries not do things that you don't want them to do. And, you know, those things you don't really see, but they're really, really important. And this idea of polarity and looking deeply at the resources that countries bring to the table helps you understand that reality. There's a long stream of things not happening that we don't want to have happen precisely because of these capabilities that we still have.
You know, under Donald Trump, the United States seemed to be embracing a much more isolationist policies and ideas, backing away from its role as a leading voice in a unipolarity. That was, I take it, a mistake.
I believe so, for sure, because the United States really does need allies to get what it wants. I mean, what do we want? We want to be secure. We want to have a prosperous economy. We want to retain this democracy of ours. And doing all of those things with allies is a lot easier than doing them without allies. There are many problems we need to tackle in the world, anything from climate change to cooperation on the global economy. And again, you want friends, you want allies who can bring things to the table. today we see what value that can bring in the sense of, gosh, you know, how hard it would be to push back against Russia's aggression in Ukraine if we didn't have a large number of technologically and militarily advanced countries on board with us. So dissing allies, getting rid of allies would have been a mistake back in the era of pure unipolarity, the 1990s. But it's an even greater mistake now, because to really compete with Russia and especially with China, you need to have friends with you. And just to quickly mention here, you know, the U.S., the roster of who are the U.S. allies also happens to be most of the world's richest and most technologically advanced economies.
Is it fair to say that Russia's moves toward Ukraine and China's more aggressive policy toward Taiwan, is it fair to say that those actions have strengthened our relationship with our allies?
Yes. China's overall more pugnacious approach to its rise from a more circumspect approach that it followed prior to Xi Jinping, that approach has had the tendency of pushing countries close to the United States. I mean, Japan, Philippines, South Korea, you're seeing them buttress their U.S. tie. And in fact, the attitude in Europe towards the relationship with China is very different than what it was 5 or 10 years ago. So definitely. And of course, Russia's aggressions towards Ukraine have done more to solidify, strengthen, make real the NATO alliance than anything that's happened since the end of the Cold War. So both of those moves have kind of actually made the road ahead for China and Russia more difficult.
You know, John Bolton, who was in a high-ranking figure within the Trump administration, has said that he believes that if Donald Trump reelected, he would have made efforts to get the United States out of NATO. That would have been a serious trouble in terms of the kind of unipolarity that you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would leave the United States without the tools that are extremely important in whatever it wants to do in international relations. And nobody is quicker to admit than I am that it would be better if our allies devoted more to defense. We see some positive developments in that regard, certainly in Japan, but also in Germany and other European countries. Definitely the frontline East European countries are making much bigger contributions to the collective defense. Sure, that would be better. But even acknowledging that allies will never be the perfect ally, going out into international politics and trying to do things without a posse of the world's wealthiest and most technologically advanced countries is going to be a lot harder than doing so with them. And I think Bolton is right. This is the one thing where I agree with him. There's a lot of evidence that Trump's inclination is towards diminishing the role of these allies, if not abrogating them entirely.
Also, talk about stepping back in Asia. I know that now it seems that we are moving forward. We have seen the Philippines ask the United States Navy to increase its presence with regard to the Philippines, that sort of thing. That strengthens this unipolarity idea that you're talking about?
Well, I think it's a reflection of the fact that in this world, if you are China or you are Russia, your options for pushing towards what they're calling multipolarity are actually unlimited, because when you try to do it, all you end up doing is solidifying, strengthening the countervailing coalition of countries led by the United States. I mean, you know, Russia, when it invaded Ukraine, it basically said, you know, we're doing this to create multipolarity. You know, we're going to push you back. We're going to get our sphere of influence in Ukraine. We're going to push NATO back to where it was in the mid-1990s. Those were the diplomatic demands emanating from Moscow prior to this invasion. And what's actually happened? The opposite. So I think that's where your question really gets at another way of thinking about this, which is I would ask people to think not just about how hard it is to be the United States and how much we're declined. Ask yourself how difficult it is to do what China is trying to do or Russia is trying to do and overturn the international order. It's not so easy.
You know, there's always been this concern that if it really wanted to, China could just go ahead and sell all its holdings in U.S. Treasury securities, and that would raise our borrowing costs. But you've pointed to the Federal Reserve as a method of keeping that from happening.
Well, in some sense, it is. It'd be shooting yourself in the foot in some ways if you're China, since China owns all of those assets, and dumping those assets are just going to massively degrade, their value to China. But I think most economists who've taken the time to study sort of the balance, what do they call it? Like the balance of financial terror, like who is held most at risk by the symbiotic relationship between U.S. debt and China's purchases of U.S. treasuries. Most economists who've taken the time to really study that relationship think that it sort of ends up in balancing in the U.S. favor, in that, yes, both countries would be hurt by a precipitous Chinese move of this nature, but the Chinese economy would be hurt a lot more.
Yeah, the United States, clearly, we're still the dominant nation, but some of our friends seem to be a little bit uncomfortable with how things are. I'm thinking of Macron in France, Lula da Silva in Brazil. They seem to at least look for some kind of for more influence in terms of the alliance that they have with the United States. Should we be surprised by that?
Oh, not at all. I mean, it's always been thus with France. It goes all the way back to De Gaulle. I mean, they've always loved multipolarity. I've always asked my dear French friends, like, why do you love multipolarity so much? France has never been richer, never been more prosperous. And look at all those horrible wars that took place in multipolarity. But they always loved it. And in part, it's for the same reasons I mentioned earlier, that it connotes for them a world in which they have a lot more influence. But the problem is, when it comes time to pay up, like, how would we actually create what Macron calls European autonomy? How would Europe come together, find agreement, create these capabilities that they would need? How would they do that without the United States helping to build those coalitions and helping with its much more advanced capabilities? It would be a very, very, very formidable road. It would be a project of generations. It's not something you give a speech about and 2 years later you have European autonomous security policy. It's not gonna get there anytime soon.
Yeah, the U.S. in the future, we simply cannot just do what we want. You're insisting that we really need to be careful about any hard bargaining with our allies. We need to resist that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think it would be really nice if the U.S. In our domestic politics, we could think about our allies as allies and not necessarily as kind of pawns to be played in a domestic political game. I know that's asking a lot. And I say this because I know that there have been many political figures, and some of them, I think, recently on the Republican side, who have suggested, Ukraine is just a kind of territorial dispute somewhere. And, we can kind of like suggest that our allies are just massive free riders and stuff. But if you interview that same politician on background, they're going to say, well, of course, I very much treasure our allies. And of course, I wouldn't want to be out doing international politics without them at our side. So it would be nice if we could kind of keep that straight and kind of control the rhetoric with respect to our allies, because they are very, very, very useful assets in international politics.
You've described the second Iraq conflict, the long war in Afghanistan. Those were really self-inflicted wounds in terms of our standing with our allies. The lessons from those, I would think, would be more careful use of military force outside of Europe or Asia, and in fact, try to avoid any kind of occupation.
Yeah, I mean, just don't do occupations. I mean, I think there is precedent for this. It's the U.S. is, it's so easy to be so pessimistic about this country when you read the news. Not blaming on you there, John. I mean, journalism is a wonderful profession, but there tends to be this great deal of despair almost if you focus on the headlines, which are properly focused on crises. But remember this, as horrible as the Cold War was, ultimately the United States learned after Vietnam, like, gosh, going off and invading, huge countries in Asia is probably not a great idea. And I know it's brutal way of thinking about this. It was a horrible, horrible experience, but at least we learned our lesson there and didn't go back. That tried to prosecute the Cold War in a different way. And I now think the same goes for our searing experiences of the global war on terror and the nation building exercises in Afghanistan and Iraq, which is like we need to think about our security going forward in a way that we not find ourselves occupying large countries and attempting to transform them politically. It's, you know, it's kind of hard to get yourself back in the mindset of what we were thinking back then to think that that was a realistic objective. But I think the lesson is that this country, with all its flaws, is capable of learning and is capable of restraining itself. And I believe going forward, my hope is that we're likely to sort of have that lesson sort of baked into the political establishment.
So more action with in concert with our allies, and look for them to be more like willing partners and followers as opposed to we tell you when you go.
Yeah, I mean, sort of make it not always transactional, so that we treat the alliance, we think of the alliance as a kind of a long-term relationship that is, that some years, sort of you're making sacrifices for the alliance, other years they're doing more of the sacrificing, and we had a few cases like that in the past, rather than as a transaction, which was the Trump approach. Like every time you go to the allies, you say, okay, what am I getting from you? What am I giving you? I don't like this balance, so you guys need to pony up. The transactional approach really actually, I think, doesn't pay out for the United States over the long term.
What about the allies? What do you think that they need to do to strengthen the alliance? You've mentioned perhaps spend more on their defense.
I think it goes beyond that. So it's not just spending more on defense, but it's spending on the right things. And that is actually a source of some frustration for many people, that the spending is not only, not as much as would be ideal, but also often not rational or not in the optimized, not in the right areas. So lots of people in Washington are still, trying to get Taiwan to purchase the kind of defense a portfolio they would really, really need to raise the cost to China of some sort of coercion against Taiwan. And similarly with Europe, there's a lot of replication. There's a lot of overlap. There's a lot of lack of coordination in these defense expenditures. So the sum turns out to be the total turns out to be less than the sum of its parts when it comes to these allied defense efforts. And so I think it's to only focus on, 2% of GDP you need to spend, that's the beginning, but that's not the end of trying to make this alliance work better.
This is not a new topic for William Woolforth. He's been writing about foreign policy, power, and perceptions during and after the Cold War for decades. He is the Daniel Webster Professor of Government at Dartmouth College. He wrote The Myth of Multipolarity for Foreign Affairs magazine, along with fellow Dartmouth Professor Stephen Brooks. Professor, this has been a real education for me. Thank you for being with us today.
Well, I very much appreciate it. It was quite enjoyable.
You can follow us on Facebook and Instagram at KERA Think. Use any podcast app to get the Think podcast, or go to our website, think.kera.org. Once again, I'm John McKay, in for Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.